Coming up, discovering Pompeii like you've never known it before.
And revisiting an old site with new secrets to reveal.
All on this edition of the Time Team podcast.
Welcome to the Time Team podcast with Martin Williams and Dr. Helen Geek, where we wanted to start by reading a few of the comments actually that we've had on Patreon to our last episode and that really interesting chat with Dr. Helen Gittos from the University of Oxford and her new theory about Certain Who and how some of the Byzantine objects found there might have actually made their way to Suffolk. She suggests that Anglo-Saxons were actually recruited into the Byzantine army and then brought those items back with them when they went over to fight.
Yes, Patreon members got an extended version of that interview, which they could watch as well as listen to, and it's still there for you now if you missed it. So we've got some of the comments. Carrie says, "So interesting. I love that searching for the possibilities is open-ended. Will there ever be a conclusion? A great thought-provoking podcast. Thanks, Helen, and Martin."
Yes, the double Helens. Yes. Thank you, Carrie, for that. Jack says, "Interesting hypothesis. My main concern deals with the exceptional nature of these finds. Do they fit better what soldiers, even elite ones, were paid or what rulers were offered as diplomatic gifts?" Interesting.
Yes, interesting to link that with Carrie saying, "Will there ever be a conclusion?" I mean, this one's going to run and run, isn't it? Tim said, "Brilliant to throw new ideas into the Sutton Hoo melting pot and explore." And that's absolutely what it's all about, Tim. You're absolutely right. So thank you all for your messages on that and on the podcast in general. And we'll have more from Patreon members later on in the podcast when I'll be answering your questions.
Yeah, that is to come. Also coming up, by the way, you'll find out what our digger driver, John Beaver, was so excited about that he insisted I go out and meet him in a freezing cold field in the Cotswolds. We also have a chat with Time Team archaeologist Meg Russell, who's going to be telling us about her family connection to the job.
First, though, I want to talk about one of the most famous archaeological sites in the world. I doubt there are many people on Earth who don't know the story about what happened at Pompeii.
Yeah, and I'm wondering, Helen, if I can have a little go at summarising. Pompeii, city near modern-day Naples in Italy, right next to a big old volcano called Vesuvius. And then in 79 AD, so this is like slap bang in the middle of the Romans, it goes bang, huge eruption. It covered the entire city in metres of volcanic ash and, you know, killed everyone there. And all that ash essentially preserved it exactly as it was, and they've kind of been unearthing it ever since.
Well, that was a masterly summary, Martin, but I have just one little quibble with it.
Just the one.
Well, you may be right in that it was slap bang in the middle of the Romans as a civilization, but don't forget that 79 AD is right at the start of Roman Britain. It's less than 20 years after Boudicca's revolt. That incredible preservation, that Pompeii is like a snapshot in time, it's really tempting to use it as an interpretation of everything that we find in Britain as well, but it's actually right at the beginning, and we've got hundreds of years of change that goes on in Roman Britain after that. So we have to remember that Pompeii can tell us loads about the first century AD, but tells us less and less perhaps about later centuries, but work's constantly going on at Pompeii to discover more.
Yeah, and there's been this brilliant documentary on TV recently, which Helen and I have been gripped by. It's been showing some of the amazing new discoveries that have been made there at a dig which has just reached its conclusion after 2 years of work. And what they found there has been astounding the world.
And we're very lucky because here to explain more about what's being found is Dr. Sophie Hay, who is not to be confused with Time Team's genealogist, Dr. Sophie Kay.
Yeah, good point.
So Dr. Sophie Hay is from the Archaeological Park in Pompeii and is also a research fellow at the Institute of Classical Studies at the University of London. Hello, Sophie.
Hi there. Nice to see you both.
Lovely to see you. Now, people might have followed the news coverage of what's been going on at Pompeii recently. They might have seen the programme on the television. But for people who might have missed what's been going, can you just explain the extent of the excavation and what you've discovered?
So the excavation lies pretty much in the centre of Pompeii, and within the city walls, only 2/3 of the city has been excavated. So this excavation is right on the edge of that 1/3 that remains completely covered in volcanic material.
What then were some of the standout discoveries that you made in this new dig that has had people just going, wow?
Yeah, well, so many. I mean, from an individual object, I was actually in the room when they were excavating the top of the marble table, and all the objects still completely in situ, upright glass vases. There was a bronze jug, there was a lamp, a bronze lamp, all exactly as the Romans had left them, standing upright on a table. And to me, that was, I mean, ridiculously amazing, because if you consider the force of the eruption, the drama of the eruption, the nature of it all, and you think, how on earth did this glass vase stay upright, intact, without a chip on it? And yet, a meter away, someone had died, one of the most horrific deaths you can imagine, in a violent, terrifying situation. But yeah, there's some kind of calm and peace about all these objects that are still left in situ.
Yes, I meant to ask you about that, because it was extraordinary to see the glass vessels and the gold coins and jewellery not melted, whereas my view of Pompeii is that it's an incredibly hot pyroclastic flow or something. But there must have been some bits that were quite almost protected, like that small room was.
Yeah, no, the pyroclastic flow, I think we've been very general about our description of it. We've said, you know, it's 300 degrees. If it was, we wouldn't have any traces of fabrics and things like that. And when we see the casts made of the people, we can see the folds in their clothing, and the wood doesn't get incinerated. There must be pockets of lower temperatures, whereby then it means we get the remains that we do. We obviously don't get wood surviving, but we get the void where it has since decomposed.
Yeah, and the wood, the technique you used to recreate that or to find out what wooden structures would have been there is something that I'd never come across before, and it's using plaster. Can you just explain that technique and how you're able to recreate these tables and beds and chests that were in these rooms?
If anything organic, so wood, material, your sort of soft tissue essentially around your bones, gets covered completely by the ash deposit, which is the pyroclastic flow. You've got to remember, in Pompeii, there's also a very, very deep layer of pumice stone. There, we can't make a cast, because pumice is like the sort of, it looks like packaging material that you'd get when you have something delivered in a cardboard box. We just get a skeleton of someone at that point. But in the ash, it forms a sort of hardened crust around whatever material it's covering. The organic material decays, decomposes, and disappears. It just leaves a void. So when we're digging, we're scraping away at the ash, and a little hole appears. And we then know that there must be a void underneath. We then pour, in this case, dental plaster. We pour that in, we wait till it sets, and then we chip away the ash around that plaster cast. And we're left with whatever was in that void. In one case, we have a rope that was coiled, and you can see the fibers in the rope. And because they're cast in white plaster, there's something very sort of ghostly about walking into a room full of this furniture, and you suddenly do sort of become really sort of apparent that this is the sort of the ghostly remains of what was here.
I just think it is amazing how much you can learn about the lives of people that were living there from what they left behind. And because it is so preserved so exquisitely, what do you think this new dig has taught us about the way people lived? Because you discovered these amazing spa and bath systems that people had. You discovered where they slept, the jewellery that they had, what they were drinking out of. There's so many little details. How do you think it adds to historical knowledge?
At a sort of micro level, obviously we're learning about those occupants in that house, and that is always interesting to us. In the wider picture, however, it's not changing technically very much how we and what we know. It's adding little details. So, for instance, at the beginning of this excavation, it started in a small residential house with a bakery attached on one side. And we got this sort of glimpse into a building site. it does help shatter that illusion that Pompeii was this sort of perfect town, as if everything was just, you know, a beautiful day. We are a building site now, and builders and workmen were discovering an ancient building site, and things were in flux and people were changing their lives. And so I kind of love it for having sort of dispelled that nature a little bit. And it gives a real sense of life. I'm an archaeologist. I prefer to study their lives than their gruesome, horrendous deaths. And Pompeii does offer that. It offers this whole long picture of what life was like.
Was it a pretty typical Roman town, or was it special in its heyday?
Some people think it's a completely bog-standard town and that these are everywhere and why do we get excited, and it's only made exciting because it's preserved in the way it is. I've travelled quite a lot around the Roman Empire, and I'm not an expert on every single city, but I do find a lot of the things in Pompeii to be of a really high quality. The decoration, especially the mosaics, the frescoes, a lot of really similar to what's going on right in Rome. And the quality is so high, so I don't believe it can just be a normal town. But at the same time, it's not talked about a lot. No one sort of refers to it much in the written sources. But there's something going on. There's something that makes it a little bit more special. And obviously, we view it as an exceptional archaeological site because of the way it was preserved.
Can I ask you about the actual business of doing archaeology at Pompeii? Because when I was watching the documentary, obviously it features a lot of images of people scraping away and using the brushes. And I thought, goodness, it looks so easy. It was just almost trowel in, mosaic. So how easy is it to uncover things at the site of Pompeii, considering what happened to it and the reason why it is covered over in the way that it is?
Yeah, no, it's exactly like that. It is just scrape away a bit of pumice and there we go. It's not faked at all on that front. It's still a complicated site, probably not as complicated as many kind of urban archaeological digs you might go on, where you've got a lens of this and a lens of that and you have to distinguish between hundreds of soil colours. But at the same time, it's really complicated because you're dealing with such a 3D jigsaw puzzle, as it were, and you're coming down from upper floors that still exist, whereas walls have collapsed. So in fact, the digging side is relatively easy, but it's the sort of engineering support and just the logistics of working out how to protect something in situ whilst allowing the dig to continue. So for instance, that bathhouse, the cold room had a big tiled roof on three sides of it that still existed. We'd love to keep the roof, but we then had to take off each tile one by one, number them so that we knew where they came from. I think although the digging looks easy, and it is at certain levels, I think the whole process of digging in Pompeii from the very top down is really complicated. And it's taken a lot of work to work out how to stabilize things, keep things, prop things up. And then beyond that, how do we then display it all to the public without all this sort of scaffolding and support systems in place?
It is so different to anywhere else, isn't it?
What happens next then, Sophie? I mean, this is 2 years of work, you know, and the rest. What happens next with the amazing discoveries that you've been making?
Well, there's still a tiny bit more to excavate in Region 9. And then after that, I think the plan for the park is actually going to be quite interesting. And people may be a little sort of shocked to hear what we're going to do. We're going to sort of vaguely stop digging in Pompeii, which seems sort of counterintuitive. But in fact, the director, I think, is absolutely right. I think that because, as I sort of kicked off with saying, actually, what we found hasn't changed the story. We know that people have private baths, for instance. We know that life for a slave in a bakery is no fun. It's awful. It's brutal, that life. We know that people decorate their houses with beautiful frescoes. So what he wants to do is take excavation and take it outside the walls of the city and into the countryside, where we have these big villas that produce food for the city and beyond. And we don't really know much about the lives of people in these places. We know they exist. We've got maybe 120 villas just around the vicinity of Pompeii. And yet we don't really know how they worked. What was their relationship with the city? how did they run? How did they function? How many people were working there? And we're getting a little tiny glimpse of it in one little excavation north of Pompeii called Civita Giuliana. And we're seeing a lot more of the side of the workers there, the slaves. And suddenly we're seeing the bedrooms where they lived. We've got casts of their beds and all the furniture in their rooms. And this is adding to the story. This is giving us information we didn't know. And that's what the director kind of wants to look at, is where are the gaps in our knowledge? And so actually, I think it's going to be a really interesting, really fascinating sort of future few years, hopefully, of exploring the gaps, being bold and not going for the easy target in Pompeii, where we know, obviously, there's a beautiful city.
Well, it sounds like you've got an awful lot of work still ahead. Sophie, the very best of luck with it.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you so much for coming to talk to us. It's been absolutely fascinating.
My pleasure.
And if you want to know more, the documentary we've been talking about is still available to watch here in the UK on the BBC iPlayer. And there's more from Sophie Hay over on Patreon, where you can actually watch an extended version of the interview you've just heard. That's there, plus so much more exclusive content from Time Team. Head over to patreon.com/timeteamofficial to find out more about how we try our best to reward you for supporting the archaeology we do and the programmes that we make.
This is the Time Team podcast, and a reminder, by the way, that if you're maybe feeling a little nostalgic for an old episode of Time Team from our Channel 4 days, or if you don't remember Time Team the first time round and you want to watch some excellent 90s and noughties telly, the original episodes are on YouTube for you right now. They're over at our Time Team Classics channel, and we're adding new old episodes all the time, if that makes sense. The next one's going online on Sunday the 16th of February, and it's episode 7 of series 19, which is the one we did at Colne Priory.
Oh, that is in a really beautiful part of North Essex, isn't it? So that one's going to be worth a watch.
Yeah, and alongside the episode, we're going to be offering a live chat. So as the episode is premiering on YouTube, a special guest watches along with you. And this time it's Time Team's creator, Tim Taylor, who's offering his insights into how the programme was made and more behind the scenes little tidbits about the dig. So make sure you check that out on YouTube on Sunday the 16th of February. Now, what I'm going to talk about now does actually sort of follow on quite nicely from this, because it relates to an old episode of Time Team. And Helen, it all starts a little bit mysteriously, really, because a few weeks ago I got a message on my phone, and it was from John Beaver. John, the digger driver who we featured here on the Time Team podcast before. Now, when John isn't stripping off layers of topsoil for Time Team, he's working on all sorts of archaeological sites. And this message said, "Martin, I'm working at a site in the Cotswolds, and we've found something you're going to want to see. Come and have a look."
Ooh, well, that's an intriguing message if I ever heard one.
Yeah, exactly. So I needed to find out what John and his team at Cotswold Archaeology had found. So John sent me the details of the secret location that they were working on, and it turns out it was actually just metres away from a site that Time Team had visited before, back in the year 2000. There'd been a Roman villa discovered. It seems, though, that that wasn't the end of the story. So despite it being about -3 degrees Celsius, Baltic and freezing, I headed off to meet John.
I wonder what it could be.
Hi, John.
Hello.
Good to see you.
How are you, Martin? You okay?
Yeah, very well. Why have you brought me here?
I'm on this job here and find something very interesting.
Well, let's have a walk up into this field, and I can see this is a hive of activity. There's your digger.
Frosted up.
Yeah, I know, it's freezing cold, isn't it? But walking across this field, there are so many trenches. There's got to be about a dozen trenches in here, all really very long, and you can see the soil piled up on either side. There's people in orange hi-vis I can see over there working away. So a lot of work going on here.
I'm Chris Leonard. I'm a senior project officer at Cotswold Archaeology. We're out in the middle of the Cotswolds at the moment.
And you found something. I can see the huge trenches that you've been digging. We're standing next to one of them and it's quite long. I mean, this is sort of tens of metres, but this isn't the only one. As I look across this field, I can count them. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. There's probably about a dozen.
Yeah, we've got about 17 open at the moment. We're doing 30 in total in this field. We think from the geophysics that there's Iron Age banjo enclosures, and now we're putting in the trenches to test that and see if we can find them.
Explain what a banjo enclosure is, and because I've heard of a banjo enclosure, but I think I needed explaining to me again. What are they? How do they work?
So they're a fairly typical middle late Iron Age type of settlement. It's a circular enclosure ditch that encloses your houses and your animal pens and things like that, and then it's got a long protruding neck coming out of it with ditches. If you asked a five-year-old to draw a banjo, this is exactly what it would look like.
And how significant then is the banjo enclosures, but also the other things that you found in this area in the context of what we already know is here? Because just in the field opposite, Time Team's been here before, unearthing Roman villas.
That's it, yeah. Time Team came out here in 2000 and dug a villa in the field right next door to us. They found not only a very early Roman villa, but underneath it, an Iron Age enclosure. They determined from this that we've got a wealthy late Iron Age family who then adopted villa technology very early on in the Roman period, almost immediately post-conquest. What we found now, the banjo enclosures, will hopefully push that back to the Middle Iron Age so we can develop the story of this site going from the Middle Iron Age to the late Iron Age into the Roman period and kind of trace one family's development through that quite large chunk of history.
I'm Beth Frankleton. I'm one of the archaeologists digging on this site. I'm currently digging a metre slot in a banjo enclosure, an Iron Age enclosure.
And what have you discovered so far? Because you've been working here a little while now, I can tell, because the hole that you're in is quite deep. So what have you been finding here?
So we've got some like bits of pottery which date the ditch. Animal bone. Basically, it's just got quite a few different fills in it, so it's like got tip fills and stuff where the sides of the ditch have come in, and like different colour fills. We sampled it for environmental analysis and stuff as well.
It's absolutely freezing today, and it has been for a little while. What's it like being an archaeologist in the middle of freezing cold winter?
I have warm socks on, and actually digging kind of warms you off anyway. I've ended up taking my jumper off a few times this week, which is surprising considering that it's not got like higher than 1 degree a week.
So this is quite unique actually, isn't it? Because it tells a story of that conquest.
It's a really good example of new ideas coming in and people not necessarily being afraid of these new ideas coming in, but actually embracing them. It's a native British family that have worked their way up and can afford this villa technology and are willing and happy to embrace it.
Okay, let me put my heated seat on.
You're showing up.
Oh, look, it's 31 degrees in here.
What's different about working on this site to some of the sites you're normally on?
Well, on this site, the client has asked for us to remove the topsoil from there and then about another bucket in half width to the side of that, got to remove the topsoil again so it doesn't contaminate the two soils.
Is there a little kink at the end of that one?
That's because it's very, very wet today. Well, it was yesterday, should I say. And sometimes it can be a bit difficult to pull on that because it pulls you towards the trench.
Sounds like excuses to me.
One of the things that archaeologists are obsessed with is looking at how ways of life change, and it is so fascinating to be able to see a single community over time moving from Iron Age fashions and habits and adopting these new Roman lifestyles. And oddly, it reminds me in a way of Cherrington, the site that we worked on last year, because that had this really beautifully built roundhouse, which normally you'd think of as being Iron Age, but it was full of really smart Roman pottery. And in fact, it was a Roman roundhouse. So seeing these precursors to Roman villas, the whole thing begins to, you start to think, well, how did an Iron Age family, how did an Iron Age community adapt to this really alien lifestyle? It is absolutely fascinating.
Okay, your Patreon questions then for Helen coming up in just a moment. But before that, we'd like to introduce you, as you often do here on the Time Team podcast, to a member of the team. And you get a chance to meet them and to find out a little bit more about what they do and kind of how they tick.
And this time it's Meg Russell. Now, you might have seen Meg on our news special recently. She's been working hard in the trenches at a number of digs, and she's really prolific on our social media channels. Meg, it is great to have you here. Welcome.
Hi, both. How are you?
I think we're very well.
We're very, very well. Now, for people who maybe haven't seen that Time Team news special yet, and if you haven't, do go and check it out because it's really interesting. Just explain what you were doing on it, because you were sort of on the, you were on the sofa like it was the One Show.
Yeah, it was really interesting and very surreal, actually. I sort of walked in not really knowing what to expect, and suddenly there were a lot of bright lights and a lot of students from Bournemouth University being absolutely fantastic, telling us exactly what to do, where to go, where the green room was. Yeah, sitting beside Derek, interviewing people, looking at VTs, it was such a different way to look at archaeology and look at what all the fantastic different projects that are going on both last year and what we're going to look at this year. It was fantastic.
Now, Meg, I want to ask you about archaeology and the family, because I should come clean here and say that I know your dad pretty well from my student days. I was in the year below him at the Institute of Archaeology. And so just you being a professional archaeologist makes me feel pretty old.
Oh.
But do I gather that you come from an even longer line of archaeologists?
Yeah, exactly right. My dad is an archaeologist. I suppose chronologically, it does start with him. He did his archaeology degree and met my mum while she was also doing her degree, and then both moved to Bournemouth for my dad to start his PhD. And a lot of my earliest memories are him typing away with his two-finger typing, which is very loud. So that's my earliest memory. But then after my dad did his degree, my nan, who has had a very, very long interest in archaeology, went on to do an archaeology degree and a master's afterwards. And she then became an archaeological illustrator and worked a lot with the Sussex and Brighton and Hove archaeological societies. And my uncle Justin, so my dad's brother, is also an archaeological illustrator and military archaeologist. And his partner is the senior archaeobotanist at Archaeology Southeast. And then there are various other distant people in my family that are archaeologists. And my younger cousins are now super interested in archaeology as well. And I mustn't forget, because that sounds like I nearly did, that my partner, Chris, is also an archaeologist. We met on excavation and is now doing a PhD in archaeology as well.
Wow. So you kind of don't need Time Team in a way, because you've got your own. You've got your own sort of team of everyone. How rare is that, Meg, to have certainly like the three generations there with your, you know, your parents and then your grandmother as well, all being archaeologists?
I think that's such a good question. I would love to find out if there are other people that are third generation archaeologists, because I'm sure there are. If you're an archaeologist, you know that it is very, very common for people to find their partners in archaeology. But I don't know how many people have children who then also become interested in archaeology. I think more often than not, it might put the children off being in archaeology.
How did you get interested in archaeology then? What made you want to become an archaeologist?
I'm about to insult my whole family because they did inspire me. But really, it was my A-level teacher. So I am from a generation that was lucky enough for the A-level archaeology to still be taught. When I was picking my options, I really wasn't interested in many things. I hadn't really found what I was good at. And so I was lucky enough to go to a college that still taught classics and archaeology. Going there, I was taught by this wonderful teacher and archaeologist called Sophia. She really inspired me to understand archaeology, not just being dragged to a wall that my dad wants to take photographs of, but about the storytelling and about the whole world of archaeology, not just in the UK and not just in a muddy field.
That is, I love the characterisation of archaeology as being a wall that my dad wants to take photos of. That's very much what my children would call archaeology, absolutely. But it's interesting, isn't it? The archaeology A level, that is much missed, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a great shame. I really do think that the A level, especially for me, was so important because I don't know that I'd have made that leap from history to archaeology at a degree level or after. It was so important for my development.
So what are you working on at the moment then, Meg?
So I'm doing my PhD part-time. It is on how experimental archaeology and ancient craft can improve well-being for the community. And so there are many great projects that are doing something quite similar. But what we wanted to really do was look at the statistics, look how it can be proven that it helps the community, because testimonially, there are so many people that would say ancient craft helps my well-being, archaeology helps my well-being. But being able to prove it is so important for funding for future projects to be even bigger and better. The pilot project for my research was The Sanctuary, which is students and staff and people from the local community. And we do experimental archaeology every week. And the idea is that I'm monitoring their well-being over the course of a year to really see what part of experimental archaeology is beneficial. But I really think there is something in this hands-on, tactile experience in creating something, and also the somatic or embodied physical aspect of making craft next to somebody else, and also knowing that your body is moving in the same way that somebody in the past did when they made a pot that you are now recreating. I think there's something really magical both to connect with the people that right now that you're sitting next to, but also the people in the past. So that's what the research is doing. I'm about halfway through now. I'm also attempting to do as many digs and extra research that I can do in the other half of my time so that I can carry on funding it.
Yeah, so it's really fascinating, isn't it, that everybody kind of understands intuitively that we get something amazing from archaeology, that it's really good for our well-being. It provides us with something to do that takes us out of ourselves, but nobody quite knows why. And so that's what you're trying to find out.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there's even a whole group of people that would be keen to say, I don't think that the archaeology matters for them. But I just think it does. And it absolutely might be so unique to each different person. But having talked to Richard Osgood and Operation Nightingale and lots of other people that are doing similar things with well-being and rehabilitation archaeology, I think we're getting closer to pinpointing the specific elements, and it absolutely has to do with feeling a purpose in your life, feeling valued, feel like you're contributing to something, which experimental archaeology and archaeology in a more general sense does, because you are contributing to that archaeological understanding. But it's also bringing people together.
Absolutely. That's been so interesting, Meg. Thank you very much for joining us and telling us all about your research and your role on Time Team, of course.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And actually, Meg, can you just stick around for a second? Because I want to get to questions now from Patreon members, but I think this first one could actually be one for you. Loads of people have been getting in touch with Patreon questions. Thank you so much if you've done that. This one comes in from Mark, and it says, during 2020, I introduced my niece to Time Team because of her desire to study anatomy, and in particular human bones in burials. Can you speculate on how the Time Team effect has affected enrollment of new archaeological students in the British university system? So how many people are you coming across then, Meg, who kind of went, oh yeah, I remember watching and learning about archaeology from shows like Time Team, and that's what made me want to become an archaeologist?
I think we make the mistake that if people weren't even born when Time Team first came out, that they might not know what it is, but it's totally untrue. I see so many people come through the university and people that I meet in my general life that say Time Team inspired me to do archaeology, or at least to have this interest in archaeology, to visit archaeological sites. It's so interesting that you say that. I think that it sells that realistic lifestyle of archaeology. It fits right into our daily life. I think whether you watched it at the time at that specific daytime TV or whether you watch it now on YouTube, any time of your life, I think it's incredibly meditative. I think watching archaeologists dig and reach that conclusion and find out that thing, it's so immersive and it makes you think, hey, I could do that. And I think that's the power of Time Team. It's not inaccessible. It really shows you that anybody could get into archaeology. If you love archaeology, that's what connects us, the love for it.
I think you're absolutely right about that, that what makes Time Team so different is the fact that we try to give people the tools to come along with us, that it's something that anybody can do looking out of the window or on a car journey or on a train or on a walk. You just need to be able to look at a landscape and you can decode it. Even if that landscape is something like buildings or a townscape, you don't have to be out in the countryside. And because of that kind of come in, everybody, get involved, because of that welcoming sense, I think it provides a kind of cozy, nurturing idea for. And if you're thinking what to do at university, you might well think, well, that's not only does that give me a really interesting intellectual topic, it also gives me a kind of nurturing community. And I think that's one of the things I love about it. Everybody's so so friendly and nice.
And that really comes across when you watch it. You really do feel like everybody is a family, and who wouldn't want to be a part of that?
Well, I think we can all pat ourselves on the back for contributing to the British university system, if nothing else.
Yes, and thank you to Mark for asking that question, which is really interesting one.
And we'd love to know actually how your niece is getting on and whether she's enjoying her studies and her research. Thank you, Meg. I think we can actually let you go now. So thank you so much for coming on, and we look forward to seeing you on either on a sofa or in a trench at some point soon.
Oh, thank you, Martin. Thank you, Helen. That was great.
Lovely to see you. Bye.
Andrew, bye.
Right, okay, question number two on Patreon comes from somebody who has done an awful lot of watching of Time Team episodes. This is Shannon, who says, I should have figured this out after all my binge watching. However, I'm still wondering how you determine where to dig for burials. Is it based on where there were detectorist finds or a previously found burial, or does more go into the determination of a site? Great question.
It is, isn't it? And in fact, you're right, Shannon, it could be almost any kind of evidence. So detectorist finds, yes, for burials that include metal work, it's usually jewellery and clothing fittings, that kind of thing, people buried in their clothes. That, of course, isn't everybody. Sometimes it's previously found burials, as you say. People have found them by mistake while looking for something else or while not looking for anything at all. And that is usually the commonest way that people find burials on ordinary archaeological sites, where you're digging in advance of development and you come across a group of burials, which could be anything from certainly from Bronze Age right up to the middle of the medieval period. But also, you have to think about other landscape clues. So for earlier periods, so Neolithic, Bronze Age, that Anglo-Saxon, etc., you might often get a mound. But of course, us landscape archaeologists, of which I'm not at all one, often look around and say, look, there's a church over there. Bet you there's some burials around it, because people forget that churchyards and townscapes and so on are landscapes like any other. Just the fact they've got a building on them instead of an earthwork doesn't mean that they're not landscapes. So yes, all sorts of evidence. You have to put it all together and try and pull something out.
Shannon, I hope that answers your question. I think it certainly does. Really great question as well. And thank you to you, Mark, as well. Some really, really great questions this time. If you have one, if you've got a question on really any aspect of archaeology or indeed Time Team for Helen, get yourself signed up to Patreon and comment on the post about this podcast. We will see your question there. Patreon.com/Time Team Official.
That's about it for this episode. Next time, find out about an archaeological technique called coring and how it can be used to look way back into the Earth's past.
And don't forget to hit follow. You can recommend us to a friend and give us a 5-star rating. We will see you next time on the Time Team podcast. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.